Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and today I'm joined by two guests. Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and also Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University. This is Episode CX, Anthology of Interest. In this podcast, the three of us will discuss three Roman topics each for 3 minutes. A triumvirate of sorts, if you will.
Alright, so Rhiannon's going to start with her first one and go.
I thought you were going to ask me a question.
What's your first one, Rhiannon?
I thought for the first one we'd talk about Cinna the poet, who's kind of got left out of our Death of Caesar podcast. Cinna was somebody who's a victim of the aftermath of Caesar's assassination, and he may or may not have been a poet. Let me read you a brief extract from Plutarch, Life of Caesar, 68. When the multitude saw his body carried through the forum, this is Caesar's body, all disfigured with its wounds, they no longer kept themselves within the restraints of order and discipline. There was a certain Cinna, one of the friends of Caesar. When he heard they were burning the body of Caesar in the forum, he rose up and went there out of respect. At once word ran through the whole throng that this man was one of the murderers of Caesar. For there was among the conspirators a man who bore the same name of Cinna. Assuming this was he, they rushed upon him and tore him in pieces. It wasn't the same Cinna. There were two men called Cinna. One of them was a conspirator, one of them was a friend of Caesar, and it was the friend of Caesar who got torn to pieces.
Yeah, this is where it gets awkward with Roman common names, I suppose. So they actually killed him because they thought he was that Cinna.
They thought he was that Cinna.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so it wasn't a poetry criticism on him.
Well, the whole idea that he's a poet, there is a Cinna who gets mentioned by people like Catullus as a friend. But most of the sources, we've got five or six sources that talk about this tearing Cinna to pieces, and they don't mention that he's a poet. There's lots of Cinnas, not just those two. Mm. But in the Life of Brutus, from memory, by Plutarch, Plutarch does say, he does mention the word poet, and that's the only place. And it is a controversial matter amongst academics whether they say he's Cinna the poet or not. He tends to get that name because in Shakespeare, he is Cinna the poet, and you actually see that happen.
I guess it shows the feelings that are running through Rome at the time.
Yeah, it absolutely is chaos, and it's one of the saddest parts of the play. You know Caesar's going to be murdered. Sometimes I forget that poor old Cinna's going to be a victim too.
Mm. And how does this kind of echo throughout, say, the Senate at the time for the people who actually did murder Caesar?
Just after the bit that I read to you, Plutarch says, this was one of the most worrying things to Brutus and Cassius, and this was what motivated them to think maybe we shouldn't hang around Rome.
Yeah.
So it has a big effect on them. They know that the people are really incredibly upset, or there is a big gang of people who will tear you apart if you were involved, or maybe if you only sound like you were involved.
Mm. And do we have any of Cinna's poetry?
We don't.
Okay.
We have him mentioned by Catullus as a friend, but we don't know what his poetry was like, except that it was what we call neoteric. So he was one of the young dudes of poetry. He was one of the new poets, one of the new young bucks, up with the fashionable people. Would have written reasonably short poetry, very carefully fashioned. If he is that Cinna, as I say, not everybody agrees with that.
There you go. 3 minutes 12.
That was too long.
No, we'll let you have that.
You've got a question as well.
So. I feel like I should have brought you into it.
12 seconds and change. I feel that I should go next because I've got something that's tangentially brings in Caesar. And one of mine is Caelius Rufus, who wants some panthers. So Caelius Rufus has been represented by Cicero in former cases. We brought him up in our Clodia episode. So he's the Caelius Rufus that Cicero was defending in that case. So he'd been romantically involved with Clodia before, and he was implicated in the murder of an Egyptian ambassador, I want to say, by poisoning Rhiannon, he says skeptically, because he didn't have that in his notes. So anyway, he moves away from the Rome, and he's trying to put on games to get the favor of the people, and he keeps writing to Cicero saying, Cicero, I need some panthers. And that's the big thing that he's aiming for. And Cicero's the governor of Cilicia at the time, which I take it has panthers. And there's a whole series of letters, which is essentially, Cicero, dude, send me some panthers. You owe me one. Other people are sending me panthers. Why aren't you sending me panthers? I could really use some panthers at the time. We never get the letters from Cicero to Caelius, which would assumably have a lot of excuses about why panthers are not forthcoming or even just avoiding the topic altogether.
Well, it wouldn't be easy to transport, you could assume.
Yeah.
And he clearly doesn't think that it's worth his while to do this.
Cicero does write to his good friend Atticus, his frequent correspondent, saying, "I have said that it is inconsistent with my character that the people of Cibria..."
Yeah, I think that's okay.
Yeah, okay, mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to let this slide. "Should hunt at the public expense while I am governor. So I can't ask the people to go out there and catch me some panthers just for my good friend Caelius."
Yeah. So,
isn't there one letter which he says he can't find any panthers within all of Cilicia? I seem to recall reading that with a Latin class once, that, you know, he couldn't find any.
Sounds familiar.
But it was across a good period of like 6 months that he was getting these letters from Caelius, and the letter would be about something completely different, and then there'd just be a line at the end go, "Oh, likewise about panthers, please send some from Cibria and have them shipped to me. In almost every letter I have written to you, I have mentioned the subject of panthers. It will be little to your credit that Paticus has sent me panthers for curio, and that you not many times as many." He's complaining that Cicero has still neglected to send him any panthers.
Yeah, and other people are doing these good deeds for other people. Mm. He's not getting that. So he's trying to build up some kind of jealousy or...
Yes. Look what all these other people are doing for me. Cicero, what have you done for me lately?
They're doing it for other people. Yeah. It sort of becomes a bit pathetic, the number of letters that he is sending in, making this request over and over and over again.
Yes. But clearly, you know, panthers are something that are important to have in when you're putting on good games. You have exotic animals, the people like that.
It would have been quite unusual at that time, I think.
Yeah.
Unusual enough for him to keep asking for them.
All right. So that's me at 3:02.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you beat me.
Caelan, are you ready? You ready? Yep. You set? Go.
Okay. Well, I'm also starting with Julius Caesar then. So it seems to be a theme. I'm going to talk about baldness. And we all know how Julius Caesar was quite sensitive about his receding hairline and wanted to comb his hair forward and wear a laurel wreath wherever possible. But emperors were also concerned about baldness as well, and they were often made fun of by the people. Poor Tiberius, the maligned Tiberius, was mocked by the praetor Caesianus at a festival called the Floralia. And so Caesianus had only bald-headed men featured in the daytime entertainments, and then in the evening procession employed 5,000 boys with shaven heads to hold the torches. Tiberius pretended not to hear about the incident, which was a way of demonstrating the fact that he was a coelus emperor, an emperor who was behaved as if he was a fellow citizen. Mm. And not all emperors took their baldness quite so well. Caligula forced men who had extravagant buffoned hairdos to have their head shaved, and he made it a capital crime for anyone to look down on his head from above there as well. So he was very sensitive about his baldness. Politicians today, to take notes, you should put up with criticism of with equanimity.
It's always puzzled me, though. Is it solely the connection with old age? I suppose it is, but I'm not sure we know. I mean, that's what we associate baldness with. Or is it a lack of virility? Or quite what associations they're putting together with this baldness.
One thing I found was something with goats. I don't know if you've heard of this one before. Yeah. Caligula made it a capital crime to refer to a goat for any reason, because Caligula had hair all over his body and none on his head, so he himself apparently looked like a goat. So there may be something to do with you look like a goat if you're bald but have a hairy chest or something like that. So,
well, that would make you super virile in Roman terms, I guess, but kind of not in a good way.
The laurel wreath in particular, does that get carried on from emperor to emperor? Because you hear about it a lot associated with Julius Caesar, but not so much later emperors. So how much of it a symbol was it contemporarily of Roman emperors?
I mean, it continues to be associated with triumph, so I assume that means it's for the special day mostly. And certainly it seemed like Caesar was pushing the boundaries when he continued to wear it as normal attire.
Yeah.
But what do you think, Clay? Yeah. Do people wear it?
Yeah, I think he sort of turned, Caesar has turned sort of something could be held against him and his baldness to an advantage. Mm. But generally, yes, I think it's only triumph, special occasions, you know, if you're awarded the corona cubica or something like Augustus. Mm. Perhaps one of the reasons these later emperors were so sensitive was that they didn't have things to cover their hair all the time. I mean, Domitian even wrote a booklet
on hair.
Yes, Care of the Hair.
He did.
Yes,
he did. All right, so I feel I should go again because I've got one that is also tangentially hair-related. This one takes us back to the Second Carthaginian War. This is Lucius Paulus and Terentius Varro. Rhiannon's nodding. Do you know where I'm going with this one?
No idea.
I have no idea either.
So Paulus and Varro were the consuls in 216 BCE, which is 2 years into the Second Punic War. And back at that time, each consul leads a volume of troops. So they consolidated their armies into 85,000 troops, and they went out to meet the Carthage army at the Battle of Cannae. What they did was the consuls take turns in the days of command. So Varro was in command one day and he was inexperienced and he made the spectacularly bad call of let's go and attack the Carthaginians and see how that works out. And it didn't. And it spectacularly didn't. And most of the Romans were massacred down to about 4,500 people out of the original forces that went up against here. The interesting things that I found is what happened to Paulus and Varro. Paulus was injured, was given a horse and was told, get out of here. And he refused to. And he sat down against a rock where he had been injured and waited till he was overwhelmed and stabbed to death by the enemy. So it's held up as a virtue of, you know, here's somebody who wanted to go down with the troops. Varro got away, if you want to call it that, and led the 4,500 soldiers to safety. And when he got back to Rome, Rome said, yes, good on you. You have come back to fight and continue to fight with us. He said, no, I don't want to be lauded. I didn't do a great thing here. Throughout the rest of his life, he gave proof that he remained alive, not from desire of life, but because of the love for his country. He suffered his beard and hair to remain untrimmed and never afterwards reclined when he took food at the table, even when honours were decreed on him by the people, he declined them, saying that the state needed more fortunate magistrates than himself. So I kind of interpret that as maybe post-traumatic stress syndrome, and for them to make a big deal about him not trimming his hair, which back then, that's interesting.
Sign of mourning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He sordid us.
And he wouldn't recline to eat, and he declined honours and everything, so I kind of think he went through a hell of a war.
Well, he's seeing himself as a symbol of bad luck, isn't he?
Yeah. So I cribbed that from a shout-out to Frontinus and his stratagems.
That's a great work for looking at sort of all the tactics of the Republican period in particular, because he has very few imperial exemplar, doesn't he? Mm. There's a few, but it's really about the great generals of the Republic.
That whole kind of idealization of the Republic that comes out even that late.
So that's my second thing of interest.
Okay, I think I can get through this in 1 minute. Is that bad?
No, go on.
We'll ask lots of questions.
I may not know the answers. I thought I'd talk about something that interested me a while ago, but I haven't looked at it recently. But I've just come back to it thinking about women's clothing and how occasionally women are described as being togate, so women wearing togas in very specific circumstances, which some people I think would argue is kind of a rhetorical device because we don't have kind of concrete examples of it happening. And the times that it's supposed to have happened are sort of shameful to women. So it's women who are prostitutes or women who are adulteresses, that they are kind of shamed into this, what we would regard, I guess, as cross-dressing.
Mm-hmm.
There is a theory that originally the toga was unisex, and then respectable women started wearing this very long, all-covering dress, the stola. When I explain that to my students, I talk about how it starts up here just under your chin and it covers every bit of your ankle. There's nothing to see. And it's quite baggy, so you don't get to see the woman's shape. So that's if you're stolate, that's a respectable woman's dress. But there are certainly literary sources and also maybe some indications from law texts that women were described at least as togate in certain circumstances. So I thought the most fun one to bring out was a two-liner from Marshall.
Marshall's great. We need another Marshall episode at some point.
People did enjoy that, I think. This is Marshall, Book 2, Poem 39. You give scarlet and violet dresses to a notorious adulteress. And the word for adulteress is a moika, a shameful, disgusting woman. Do you want to give her a gift she deserves? Send her a toga. And that's the last word of the poem. It's the kick in the tail there. What she deserves is to wear what is, for a woman, a shameful costume.
Have we found any statues of women in togas at all? Or
there's certainly nothing found. And okay. The only concrete, if you can call it that, reference to something that you can see, which is a woman in a toga, is when Livy refers to the statue of Cloelia on a horse in a toga. And Cloelia was definitely not an adulteress. Mm. She's a virginal, legendary Roman woman who kind of saved all of these hostages, got them away from the enemy and brought them back to Rome. So the statue's been put up to her, not to shame her, but to commemorate her. A rare public statue of a woman from early Rome, in fact. It's a bit of a strange conundrum in that, of course, we don't get many depictions because if this happened, it's not something people want to remember. Mm. You're not going to put that depiction on your grave or put it up in your household as something to be celebrated. I noticed that in the Loeb translation by Shackleton Bailey, he translates toga as gown and then puts a little footnote. Maybe he just thinks it will sound wrong saying buyer a toga, or he doesn't really buy that that's what happened.
But in the original Latin, it's quite clear.
It says mite toga.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
Send her a toga.
Even I know enough Latin to work that out. Kaelin, do you have another one?
Yes. I'm going to talk about imperial stupidity. In particular, an edict of the Emperor Claudius. So quite often you have emperors issuing edicts, the way of communicating with the public on some non-traditional issues. So rather than, you know, financial policy, they might talk about their character. Claudius issued 20 edicts in a single day during his censorship, for example. So he was particularly fond of this style of communication. And in one early edict, he defended his irascibility and his anger, so his irrecundia and his ira. Maybe this was a way of saying, I'm not going to be like my predecessor Caligula, who was very much known for his anger, as Seneca talks a lot about that in his work De Ira on anger. He also gave speeches about his own stupidity, stultitia. So in these, he claimed that he'd only pretended to be stupid during Caligula's reign in order to ensure his own survival. So he was playing the fool, apparently. Then the emperor received a reply to his speeches, an anonymous pamphlet entitled The Rise of Fools, or The Rise of Idiots, began to circulate, proposing that no one would actually pretend to be stupid. Maybe the emperor really is stupid. It's an indication of this dialogue we sometimes get between emperors and the people. Rhiannon's busting to say something here.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, it's like the question in Hamlet, is he mad or is he pretending to be mad? And also, it just fills me with happy memories of watching I, Claudius. And the whole basis for I, Claudius is that he survives because
he's playing the fool.
He's playing the fool, yeah.
Being called stupid, is there a Latin term there that can be interpreted in other ways? I'm just wondering if that's edging towards lunacy or if it's a comment on intelligence.
He talks about his stultitia. That comes from Suetonius. The rise of fools is actually in Greek, moron epanastasis.
A moron.
The moron is genitive plural, meaning of the fools. Yeah. So there's been various different interpretations as to how we should read that Greek line. We're not quite sure there, but certainly there was a pamphlet which was circulating in response to these speeches. Claudius was saying, I was only pretending, don't worry.
Yeah. Well, given that, you know, he was well written, he wrote his own biography, if I remember correctly, and like a history of the Etruscans, and I would definitely not call him stupid.
No. But it was anonymous. That was the thing, you know. You can get away with these things if it's anonymous and no one denounces it.
And maybe it's part of that survivor guilt problem, that kind of trying to explain how you just sat there and didn't say anything through the reign of Caligula.
Yes.
The way that that's being represented.
Mm. So my last interest that I've got here is The Last of the Ptolemies.
Mm. Ooh.
Nice dramatic title. So Cleopatra and Antony have three children. They have twins, a boy and a girl named Alexander Helios and Cleopatra Selene, which I didn't come to the conclusion quite as quickly as I should, that that's a reference to the sun and the moon, which was quite nice, and a younger son named Ptolemy Philadelphius. And I don't know what that's a reference to, something Greek related.
Brother lover.
Sure.
What Philadelphia means.
Why not?
Well, and that's a reference to that whole kind of sticking together of the dynasty.
So Octavian comes into Alexandria and takes over Egypt, and Antony and Cleopatra commit suicide, And Octavian takes the three children and essentially puts them in his triumph. And he kills Caesarion, which is Caesar's son with Cleopatra, and his legitimate challenge to being Caesar's heir. He also kills one of Mark Antony's son, Antilius, who was betrothed to his own daughter. Antilius was hiding in a temple. So he has the three children in his triumph, and then essentially you don't hear about the boys again. The assumption is that they didn't survive into adulthood, but there is mention of Cleopatra Selene married off to King Juba, and the boys are mentioned as being granted their lives as like a wedding present, but they're never heard from again, so the assumption is that they don't survive. Anyway, Cleopatra Selene goes off to Mauritania with Juba and lives out the rest of her life there and has a son, one son and one daughter. We don't hear anything about the daughter. The son is named Ptolemy, last of the Ptolemies. He grows up to be the king of Mauritania and is then invited by his Roman relatives to come and visit Rome. And because he's the cousin of Claudius, if you want to go through that family tree of Claudius's mother was one of Mark Antony's daughters. Mm-hmm. So they're cousins. So he goes to Rome and it's his second cousin Caligula on the throne, and Caligula kills him. Mm. Kills him because he's probably jealous about the amount of money that Ptolemy has.
But I'm going to say the amount of hair he had.
Could be hair related too. And that's also in I, Claudius. He's a minor character who gets offed.
I had completely forgotten that
as well.
Yeah.
We need to rewatch.
So there you go. Of interest. I'm done.
That's fantastic. It really shows how much those sort of royal families around the Mediterranean can all connected. Yeah. You know, often we think of, you know, the Roman Empire as a triumph of Rome, but we have all these other client kingdoms around there and they have their own stories which are intertwined with Rome, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, I was amazed at how far the bloodline went, though, of Mark Antony, because you would think that you wouldn't want to wipe that out if you want to be thorough about it so that nobody rallies around him and creates some competition. But the fact that he was actually a client king of Rome, so after that, Mauritania just becomes a province. Two provinces, but it actually survived that long until Caligula offed it. So
it's more important to wipe out the direct descendants.
I would think so, but
like with Caesarion.
Yeah, but the sources say that it was probably he was jealous of how rich Ptolemy was. So there you go. Oh, and the other interesting thing about that story, this is another of interest maybe, is that Ptolemy, his name comes from his mother's side of the family. So it was more important to carry on the name from the mother's side rather than from Juba's side.
I'm going to take you to the 5th century AD, and we're going to talk about a big apple.
Is this Rome anymore?
It is Rome. Oh, yes. Yes, it is Rome. We're in the 430s. You know, they're still Roman emperors. We call them Byzantines, but that's wrong. They call themselves Roman. And the emperor Theodosius II is on the throne. I mean, he ruled from 402 to 450, so much, much longer rule than many of the early emperors. But a poor man brings an enormous apple to show Theodosius II, and the emperor and the senate are all amazed at the apple's huge size. Quite often in the early empire as well, we get these stories about fantastic things being brought to and shown to emperors. Mm. So Theodosius II gives the apple as a present to his wife, Eudokia. But Eudokia then regifts the apple, we might say, to a man named Paulinus, who was actually a childhood friend of Theodosius II. They studied together, and now he's been promoted to high office, so he's a leading senator. And Paulinus had been unwell, and she thought the large apple would cheer him up, so she regifted it. Now, Paulinus didn't know that Theodosius II had given the apple to Eudokia in the first place, so he also re-gifted the apple, but back to Theodosius II.
Oh, awkward.
Yep, very awkward here. So Theodosius summons his wife and asks her, "Where is the apple I sent you?"
And knowing full well where the apple
is. Oh, yes, he knew she'd given it to Paulinus. But Eudokia says, "I ate it." The emperor made her swear whether she had eaten it or sent it to someone else, and she repeated that she ate it all herself. And then Theodosius II ordered the apple to be brought in before his wife. And this was proof, at least in his mind, that his wife Eudokia was in love with Paulinus. He then had his childhood friend Paulinus put to death. And Eudokia was devastated and asked for permission to go to the Holy Land on a pilgrimage. This was probably her second pilgrimage, and she never returned to Constantinople. And even on her deathbed, she swore that she was not responsible for Paulinus's death because they hadn't been having an affair.
Wow. Apples, man, they're not worth it, are they?
Well, apples actually a lover's gift in Byzantium. So, you know, by re-gifting the apple, it wasn't a very good thing.
All right, never give gifts.
Ah, no. All right, last one, Rhiannon.
Okay, I thought that I'd stick with women and, to a certain extent, clothing. It's all we're interested in, apparently. And the Romans attempt to control this and other things with sumptuary legislation, which is something we could talk about at more length, but I thought I'd just zone in on some parts of this. So this might seem a bit weird to us, although I'm sure we have versions of it.
So this is legislating what you can wear?
What you can buy, what you can spend money on.
Yeah.
And often we zone in on the laws that are connected with what people can wear or what they can display. So it's a law that says you can only spend so much money on a carriage, or you can only spend so much money on a costume. You shouldn't possess, for women, one of the laws. In fact, the one I was going to zone in on is the Oppian law, the Lex Oppia, from 213 BCE, which specifically said no woman should have above half an ounce of gold.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a problem for me, I have to say. Nor wear a dress of different colours, that would be more of a problem. Nor ride in a carriage in the city or in any town or within a mile of it. You've got to measure that carefully, unless on account of public sacrifices. That would be your get out if you're caught driving in a carriage within a mile of a city. It's often one that's cited and thrown around as this attempt by the Romans to control women, because it does specifically cite women there.
Yeah.
It was actually repealed after 20 years, which I think a lot of people forget when they talk about it. It didn't last that long. It was very unpopular. If you remember the little anecdote that you told, which was about 216 BCE.
Yeah, this is Carthage War.
We're in the
territory.
Second Punic War.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a time where we might be trying to pull in and restrain. The conversation around sumptuary legislation, kind of scholarly talk about it, is really about whether this is concerned with people kind of reining in what they spend because we're at war, or is it about trying to control what women do? Or is it actually an attempt to prevent this sort of competitive consumption? So we don't want, what eventually does happen in some senses, the Republic to fall apart because some people are attracting more attention or power to themselves. And this could be a kind of early version, and there are different versions of it that come up throughout the Republic and even beyond, arguably, that we don't want people to separate themselves away. We've already got this very strict hierarchy in the Roman Republic. And in fact, what we want is to maintain that social control and not have a certain group of very rich elites set themselves apart, make themselves look different, make themselves look more special. And I'm quite attracted by that theory on sumptuary legislation. It's the kind of law, they always get repealed eventually. And I get the feeling that one of the reasons that happens is it's very hard to police it or police it effectively, or there will be powerful people who really don't want it, plenty of voices against it. So it's a hard law to maintain.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, as always, very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow all of us on Twitter. Pen's at the ready, Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Kaelin will discuss his new book on the Equestrian Order. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.